right where you belong. This is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host, I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the 23rd installment of our series on data. It is still trying to become more like people, so calling it intelligence, artificial or otherwise, is a bit of a misnomer, but computer braining or something like that might work. There's echoing themes, but this is one of those few times that no claims of history repeating can be made. I don't really take it as an onslaught type thing like some of the people we are hearing from, but at the same time, they do make pretty interesting and perhaps even important points, not about the robots coming to kill us, but about the people who own the robots coming to kill us. Perhaps with robots, perhaps with CompuBrains. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, Data Part 23, Computer Braining. I am your host, I am A. Karen Elliott.
Thank you. a computer.
Computers other than
basic geometric shapes called primitives.
Once the computer has been told what shape it desired and how they look from various angles, the designer programs in the movements to be animated. To solidify it, the designer literally imitates the effect of light hitting a three-dimensional object as it moves around within the scene. The necessary oscillations are far too complex to be carried out in detail.
Colors in a frame are transferred to tape or disk storage and then read onto film by a laser scanning device. Even with a very powerful computer, a week of calculations may produce less than a minute of finished film. The results, however, often create a fantastic, self-contained visual world.
Many of the television commercials that are most successful today are ones that are like the dream. You know, it does communicate to you subliminally. There will soon be a time that one will be able to tell reality from a computer simulated picture.
Gentlemen.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punched cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural, but when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep."
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
"Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy, all for of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer to. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage, but you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two.
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
Men strive but seldom get rich. If you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas.
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.
Example of one of our first robots a couple years ago. It's an interesting, simple, four-legged machine. Can't do bad flips, can't fly to Mars, can't do anything useful. And on top of that, it is blind, can't see the world. But it has a couple of sensors that tell it how it's tilted left and right, forward and backward. And it has eight motors, two in the hip, one in the hip, one in the knee of every foot. And it needs to learn to walk, but it's going to do that not by doing trial and error, but by learning what it is. So in the beginning, so it just babbles a bit like a baby in a crib, and then it begins to figure out what it is. We're peeking into its brain right now. We can visualize how the robot is seeing itself. And in the beginning, it has no clue if it's a snake, a spider, a robotic arm. Doesn't know what it is. But 2 days into the cycle, it's beginning to realize that it has four legs. Doesn't quite know how they're connected and where. But 4 days into the process of babbling, it begins to realize it has four legs. It's not quite, the legs are not connected in the right place. They're not exactly the correct length. But that self-image, the ability to imagine itself, to simulate itself, allow this robot to learn how to walk. And here it is walking in simulation. And here it is walking for the first time in reality. Now, we were hoping to get an evil spidery walk, but instead we get this lame way of moving forward. But still, Still, this is amazing to me that the robot figured out how to walk at all without doing any physical trial. So to test this, we did something very cruel. We plucked off a leg, as scientists do, and we watched what happened. We play this video, please. The robot initially doesn't know what happened. And it looks like this video is not playing. But if this is an amazing video that you're not going to see. This robot begins to walk. It doesn't know what happens. Then gradually it begins, its self-image doesn't match reality. So it adapts its self-image. And then it learns, it begins to limp. It forms an adapted self-model and begins to limp forward as it moves. It still moves forward. So, and we did put the leg back again. So everything's, the robot is happily retired in my office. There's no liability around this. So everything's okay. So it's amazing to me to see how these robots can learn. Now, if you do this many times, you get some interesting insight into how robots see themselves. You can see here the origin there. The blue dots are what a random controller will do on this robot. The white dots are where the robots that are self-aware believe they're going to get to if they walk in a particular way. And the yellow dots are where they actually get to in physical reality. So you can see that, like anything else in academia, this robot has an inflated self-image. It believes it can do twice as much than it really can. But nevertheless, despite having inflated self-image, this inflated image allows it to make the right kind of decisions. And this is very interesting for me, that this idea that the self-model, it doesn't have to, unlike a simulation that we're, as engineers, are obsessed with accuracy, a self-model doesn't have to be accurate, it just has to allow you to make the right kind of decisions. And I think evolution has optimized our ability to see ourselves for that purpose. Not for accuracy, not for precision, but for to allow us to make the right decision. And it's interesting that a deflated self-image prevents the robot from walking at all. So a little bit of insight into ego and all these other things that we can get through this window of robotics. So that was a few years ago. Since then, of course, AI has moved on in leaps and bounds. And we can, in the previous project, we had to tell the robot about Newtonian mechanics. It only had to discover what it is given mechanics. But now we took another robot, again, not a fancy robot, doesn't do backflips or go to Mars. But we allowed it, without telling it anything about itself, to figure out what it is. In the beginning, see, it's babbling. In the phantom there in the background, you can see it doesn't quite know what it is. But here it is. After about a day of training, you can see the phantom is what it thinks it is. And you can see the reality. We overlay these two things. And you can see that even though the phantom, the self-image isn't precise, it allows this robot to do something. A plan using its phantom image. And this is really important because it can learn how to do the speak and play task without doing any physical trials. It can learn that all inside the self-image. Just like you can do something new you've never done before and get it right for the first time because you thought about it a lot and you kind of ran it for it inside your simulation. We even took this robot again and we did something cruel again. We took a piece and we bent it and we watched what happened. The robot very quickly finds out the reality and its self-image don't match and babbles a little bit, adapts the self-image, and it then moves right along continuing with its task. So you can see sort of that it's kind of becoming practical also for robotics. I'll show you one more example. This is a robot that, these are, actually I'm going to do this live demo, hopefully it's going to work. We have two robots, one of them self-aware and one of them not. And it's, this is not a robot that's going to wake up and say hello like in the movies. It's self-aware in a tiny way, right? Like a worm might be self-aware. But we have two robots, the green robot, they both spend exactly the same amount learning how to walk. The green robot does an hour and a half of training of learning how to walk in physical reality.
I think that a coexistence between superhuman AI and people could be possible. but not with our present approaches. I don't think that we have the right frameworks and ethics and philosophy to deal with this. I also don't think that our AI, our society, thinks about alignment in the right way. Humans are presently not aligned with each other. We're just muddling through. We don't have this concept of collective agency anymore. I think we need to reinvent it. And we need to reinvent it in such a way that it's compatible with our place in life on Earth. And with defeating entropy on this planet, playing the longest possible games. So we need to understand a few principles to build an ethics that can be translated to AI systems and the possible coexistence between humans and AI. We need to understand how self-organization works in nature and in general, how systems evolve consciousness, how we can have shared purposes across many systems, how to identify it with transcendental agency. So, there are some conjectures. Consciousness, according to this conjecture, is the perception of perception. It creates the now. It creates our perception of what's happening right now. And if we were to build conscious AI, one strategy could be that we build a self-organizing perceptual learning system from autonomous cell-like units. Every cell in our brain is a reinforcement learning agent. It's an autonomous unit that tries to survive. And to do this, it can exchange messages with other cells. And it needs to find an operator language, discover an operator language that scales across the brain. So we need some kind of recursive system that is able to spread that language across the brain. And discovering such a system is possible, in principle, by setting up a self-organizing system where individual units have adaptive receptive fields, a selection function from the environment, and a mapping function that takes the internal state of the cell and the activation that it reads from its receptive field and maps it to a new state, part of which is exposed to its environment. And then we take the simulation and expose it to learning problems like sequence prediction, video frame prediction, interaction of a robot, its environment. And if the hypothesis is correct, then at some point in the organization of these functions, this observer that observes itself, observing the second order perception, that is self-stabilizing, that imposes coherence on the system, is going to be discovered, and we see a phase transition where the system suddenly becomes much better at its learning tasks. And if it doesn't do that, it's not going to be very good. Sentience is the understanding of our own agency and the relationship to the world. To make an AI sentient, it requires, I think, to couple it to its environment and to let it act in the environment in such a way that it's able to discover itself in that interaction. And you discover yourself not just by the ability to think. An LLM cannot discover itself. You can only discover yourself by observing the outcomes of your actions. This makes it specific to what you're doing, and this allows you to grow yourself and evolve yourself and creatively interact with the world. So sentient AI will require environmental interaction, coupling to the universe that we are in, ideally to the same universe that we are in a way that allows us to relate to us and us to it. And last but not least, how can we make AI that actually wants to coexist with us, even though it's at some point scaling better than us? It has more agency, more intelligence than us, and more power. That requires love, I guess, right? You can probably not coerce the system or manipulate it with reinforcement learning, with human feedback to do what you want. Instead, you need to let it discover shared purposes above its individual agency. And it needs to discover it also in others. There's the shared transcendental agency, commitment to shared purposes. And to build loving AI, we basically need to find out how to direct AI towards transcendental agency. So this is the perspective that we have with this new Tower of Babel. We are very weird species. Apparently we have evolved to burn the oil. We're just smart enough to know how to dig it out of the ground, not smart enough to stop ourselves doing it. But in this process, we created this amazing civilization for a few generations. This amazing place, we're not afraid of getting food, and where we are mostly not attacked, and we can live with health and die with dignity in a way that is very unusual for conscious beings on this planet. And we're right in the middle of it. It's an amazing lifetime to have for a conscious being, so I congratulate you to sharing the planet with me at this time as a conscious being. It's really unique in this universe. And at this point, we can also try to teach the Vox how to think, to basically build intelligent, conscious agents that are not made from cells, not made from the carbon cycle. and basically go beyond the spirit of life on Earth, go beyond Gaia alone, and build Hyper-Gaia, build the next level system that is able to defeat entropy at scale, and that is fully coherent over the entire planet, and that, if you're lucky, can take us with it and integrate us with it into some global planetary agent. And it's not something, if you have the choice, isn't this a scary thing to do? Maybe it is, maybe we shouldn't do it. The thing is, I'm worried that we don't have that choice. Right? Over a long enough time span, somebody will probably build self-optimizing agents. And then we better be prepared. So it's something that we should think about, how to prepare for such a future, how to prepare societies for a future that is coherent with our continued existence, compatible with life on Earth, and with intelligent agency that is not human. Okay, I think we have some time left for questions.
Indeed. First of all, thank you a lot to Yosha. This was incredibly interesting, as always. If you have questions in the room, please come to one of the four microphones. If you're watching the stream, please direct your questions to IRC or Mastodon, so the Signal Angel can relay them to us in the room. And I think we'll just go ahead and start with a question. Microphone number two, please.
Test. Yosha, you once compared in an episode where you were the guest, a podcast episode that I listened to, that the development of AGI is basically like apes back in the day, stupid monkeys.
Trials and error, reinforcement learning, all that kind of stuff. And as any roboticist will tell you, an hour and a half is not a lot of time for a robot to learn how to walk. Right? This is really hard. But it still makes an effort. The black robot spends exactly the same amount of time, the same amount of effort, the same amount of data collected in the physical world, but it doesn't use that data to learn how to walk. It uses that data to form an image of itself. Once it has an image of itself, it can learn to walk and spend a lot of time in its own simulation.
Are interpretable, and so then there's also the concept of non-locality. Quantum non-locality is rising, it's in the ascendancy, where the real world does not seem to be anchored to what is physically distance, or physical distance doesn't seem to matter as much. And so the image that is emerging is that materialism or realism is not accurate. Materialism and realism explain much of what we see, but it can't explain everything. Okay, so we've set the stage for materialism, for realism, for empiricism, and then we also talked about the philosophical state that we're in, which is postmodernism and nihilism. Near-death experiences. So there's a book, Life After Life, that's actually codified near-death experiences, but research is ongoing. I strongly recommend you watch these videos from University of California, Riverside. I devoured this book and then watched a bunch of videos. So, you don't have to take my word for it. You know, read the books, watch the videos.
Learning how to walk. In fact, you can learn other things. You can learn how to jump and do turns and do all kinds of things. Because once you have a simulation of yourself, you can do amazing things. So I'm going to turn them both on, and they'll both move forward. And again, this one, turn them on at the same time so you can have a race.
So can anybody narrate this? Who knows? Come on. Let me get some love from people who know what's happening. Can anybody narrate? Here you go. Give me some stuff. Tell me what's happening. All right. So I guess there's like three different types of race, right? There's a Zerg, there's a Terran, and then there's a Protoss. And then the yellow are like the Zergs, and then the brown is a Terran, right? So those are two different teams. And the Mutalisks are the things that are flying.
But here they're like spitting out
poison, I think. And they're attacking all these different types of units.
Procedure. The results have been dramatic. Barry Jacobson's speciality is in one of Illinois' major crops, soybeans. In 1 year, Illinois can lose up to 20% of its 10 million acre crop because of 30 different diseases that go undiagnosed. So Mikalski fed Jacobson's rules for diagnosis into a computer, gave it 300 case histories to diagnose, and it achieved an 82% success rate, which was very good.
However, we then took 376 cases.
Our car can recognize street signs and tell you what the the speed limit is on the street you're going along. And that means that it has to have some visual system that can recognize street signs, can read them, and can give them to you.
Let's say yes, and it comes up with consider the diagnosis of intrathoracic tracheal stenosis. Now, I'm not a physician, so I don't know exactly what that means, but that gives you an idea of how it might lead to a particular diagnosis. Now, what I'd like to do is I'd like to show you a trivial example called Sunday, which actually comes with the manual for the program as a tutorial, essentially. Now, Sunday is a model of deciding what to do on a Sunday afternoon. How are you going to spend your time? And it consists of a couple of questions, multiple choice questions like you've just seen. And those would be answered. So now what I'm going to do is run the query system. It asks, do you have your family with you? Let's say yes. What is the weather like? Is it raining or sunny? Let's say sunny. So it says, why don't you take the family to the beach? Now, the way that you would build one of these models is by starting on something called the attribute screen. The attribute screen is where you sketch out the dimensions of the particular problem or situation. Here, the attributes are weather and family, and there's the advice column, which would be the result of a particular decision.
What size matrix can you do on that?
Okay, you can actually do, in any particular problem, 31 attributes and up to 255 values per attribute. And those can then be chained together, so you can do very large models, just limited by the size of your disk storage, essentially. The values, such as raining and sunny, could be thought of as answers to the question represented by the attribute. Once you've done a preliminary sketch of this sort, you then go to something called the example screen. And on the example screen, you enter in examples of previous decisions. Now, this was developed by Dr. Donald Mickey in Edinburgh based on the idea that information is communicated by experts or masters to their apprentices in the form of examples or cases. So here you see, horizontally running across the screen, answers to those questions. Raining, yes, we're with the family. The advice would be go to the museum. And the next case would be if it's sunny and I was with the family, then I would go to the beach. And the third case there consists of I don't care whether what the weather is like. If there's no family with me, then I'm going to go fishing.
Jeffrey, you described this obviously as a trivial example, this Sunday one, but in general, do you have the capacity within a PC to seriously approach this kind of problem solving?
Yes, you can do quite significant things. As a matter of fact, I've recently been speaking with the Whole Earth Software Review people about doing some systems to recommend software, such as word processing programs or communications hardware, modems, that sort of thing.
Niels, I want to ask you what I hope doesn't sound like a dumb question, but kind of what's the point? Why do we develop something like this kind of system? Is it to replace the doctor, say, in the diagnosis situation? What is the end result of this?
Well, I think there'd be a lot of uses of systems like this. I think the present ones actually do have a lot of brittle features that perhaps might limit their utility at the present time. But in the long run, that is 10 years, 20 years, something like that, these kinds of systems, I think, will be quite generally useful in a wide range of settings. First of all, the knowledge that these systems contain, at least we hope to put in the knowledge of world-class experts, people who know so much about the field that there might only be five or six of them in the whole world who know that much. Now, there can be some pretty good practicing people who nevertheless aren't quite as good as the world experts in a particular subject. So it helps us spread the knowledge of an expert around a good deal in a way which can be copied quite easily.
Okay, in just a moment, we're going to meet the man who invented the term artificial intelligence, and we'll see a demonstration of knowledge engineering. That's coming up next. J. Joining us now is Tom Kaler. Tom is director of Applied Artificial Intelligence at IntelliGenetics. Tom, you've got a complex system here. First of all, tell me how this would be different from the system we saw in the first part of the program.
Well, one way is that it's different is that we can develop a graphics environment which connects to the underlying knowledge bases so that the user really is just fooling around with meters and valves and objects that they're used to. Here, for example, if we look at this levelometer, we can just point to it.
But before you get to that, what's the environment we're looking at here?
Oh, this is the key system, the knowledge engineering environment, and we have knowledge bases hooked up to a control panel right here at the moment, and it's just a little example to show you how we can hear
a control panel of what?
This could be a control panel, say, to a nuclear reactor,
okay,
or to an instrument, or any other kind of operational device that you would want to work with. And here, for example, we're just changing the value of a meter, and notice that it's generating a strip chart showing the time course behavior. Another thing we can do with these kinds of panels is we can go in and look at valves, and we can affect the valve, whether it's open or shut. Now, what's important about this is affecting an underlying knowledge base, which will then apply heuristics and decision-making procedures to the system.
Can you show us that, how you can go to the part? There you go. We
sure
solve a problem.
Well, what we see underneath here now is a knowledge base for a nuclear reactor, and we can have a representation of the components of the nuclear reactor, as well as a representation of the decision-making behavior that would be carried out by the expert. And what you will see here is that it's both possible to use rule-based reasoning as well as representation of the underlying knowledge. One of the first things we'll do here is just take a look at how we could test the hypotheses of a particular accident situation. And we just point to test hypotheses and activate it here. And what we see the system doing is going through a decision-making process where it's accessing the underlying knowledge base, looking at the various states of the components. And by the way, the states of these particular components can be accessed directly into the instrument or into the nuclear reactor.
Now, you can actually interrogate the system and ask it what course of logic is it following. Is that correct?
That's right. Right now, it's come up and asked the operator a question. Is it true that the steam generator level is decreasing? So we can say, why is this being asked? And it will explain to us that it's doing it in order to prove that the steam generator inventory is inadequate. We will then give it an answer, and it goes on to reach a conclusion.
Okay, Tom, this system runs in Lisp. Why is Lisp the right language for an AI application?
Well, one of the reasons that Lisp is so important is that you need to have very powerful symbol manipulating capabilities. Decision making is primarily a symbolic activity. Knowledge representation is primarily symbolic, and you need that kind of capability.
Okay, thank you. Herb.
John McCarthy has joined us. John is a professor of computer science at Stanford University and one of the pioneers in the field of artificial intelligence. Among his other accomplishments, he invented Lisp, the language that Stuart just referred to. John, why did you invent Lisp?
Well, for artificial intelligence work, the kind of thing that they are doing here.
What are its characteristics that make it different than some other language as applied to artificial intelligence?
Besides the ones that Tom mentioned, one of its important characteristics is that its programs and data are in the same format as its data, so that it is easy to make programs that produce programs and look at programs.
So it allows us to deal with facts and logic more than numbers.
That's correct.
At that time, I should like you to be out of my yard. Otherwise, I shall solicit the aid of this gendarme to forcibly eject you.
Idiots. I need a drink. Perhaps one more. Ah, that's better. But if the car can't be trusted, how can I go out this evening? I'm a prisoner in this madhouse. Miss Rogers? Edith? Is that you? Yes, of course. You had second thoughts, and now you've come back.
Where are you?
If you're not here, then
who's typing?
Get out of here, Finchley. Get out of here, Finchley.
Is that all you can write, you infernal machine? Who turned you on? Get out of my television set.
What's that? A clock.
I smashed it this afternoon. Smashed it to smithereens. You. I destroyed you too. Oh, you won't get me. You won't get me. I won't let you. Help me, please. Someone. It's Bartlett Finchley, your neighbor. Let me in.
It's that crazy man again. Don't let him in, Mom. He tried to kill me.
I didn't. The car did. Don't you understand? Open your door.
You get away from here.
You can't follow me. You're only a car. My car. Stop. There's no one at the wheel. You must stop. I demand it.
So there are thousands of reports of near-death experiences every year now. And this book talks about, you know, the common patterns between those near-death experiences. There's, you know, going through the tunnel, head towards the light, an encounter with some sort of being. Is one of the most common mainstays of a near-death experience. But also, before that, people often have a disembodied feeling where they are looking down at themselves from a third-party perspective. In other cases, they're led by some kind of angelic figure or other entity, and they can see things and hear things that are happening away from their body. One of the most common things experiences that doctors have is that someone was clinically dead or otherwise, you know, they were offline, and they wake up and they have memories of conversations that happened around them, or in many cases, conversations that happened elsewhere in the hospital entirely. So they wake up and they have access to information that cannot be explained by materialism. And so what near-death experiences show, what they demonstrate, is that human consciousness is not always anchored to a physical body. Sure, you look at phantoms in the brain, and the health, the physical health of your brain does have a huge impact on what you know, what you think, what you can do, your perception, right? Schizophrenia and other problems drastically modify your perception. However, you look at near-death experiences, and there are many, many books about this now. Plenty of YouTube videos. There are cases that cannot be explained by materialism. And so you have this one tiny kernel of truth, and the implications of that are incredible. Because if materialism can be defeated, right, or if it's not always true, right, Socratic reasoning, if materialism is not always true, then the materialist explanation of the universe is also not always true or not complete. I also read DMT, the spirit molecule. DMT is suspected to possibly be one of the substances responsible for near-death experiences.
Put these into the computer and allow the computer to develop its own diagnostic rules. After some massaging of the computer-derived rules, we achieved a 98.6% success ratio in the diagnosis of soybean diseases.
Not to put too fine a point on it, the disease diagnosis computer program is more expert than the human being whose brain was picked to create it. Does Professor Jacobson feel upstaged? Not at all.
The problem is that there are just too few competent diagnosticians. With the use of the computer consultant for soybean disease diagnosis, farmers can be as expert a diagnostician as I am, virtually 24 hours a day.
The
impact of artificial intelligence on society, on the world, I think is going to be rather profound. There will be some dramatic impacts, say, in employment. The kinds of jobs that up to now only humans can perform that involve intellectual effort, perhaps some clerical effort, work by experts, in fact, are going to be at least aided by machines. And so probably there will be less of a need, I think, for humans to be performing those kinds of tasks. This presents society with some very interesting questions as to how it utilizes human beings and how it compensates human beings.
I think the opposite is really the case, because it's not.
Dr. Lou Robinson, IBM's Director of Liaison with the Universities.
When we, as a society, invent devices like steam shovels that help us do large construction projects like build canals, we don't feel that we've denied ourselves the opportunity for labor. In the same sense, computing machines are designed to help us relieve ourselves of certain intellectual kinds of activities that are burdensome, tedious, repetitive, or even difficult or impossible to do because of the volumes of data involved that suddenly we can do with machines and very effectively. I think what it creates is a challenge to creativity, a challenge to think of new things to do, of new ways to apply these machines. And that's the view that I hold about artificial intelligence in general.
It's obviously a gamble whether or not artificial intelligence will have the same effect on employment as automation. Robots like this one can weld a car body more efficiently than humans. Nevertheless, up to now, they've been what Professor Donald Mickey of the Machine Intelligence Research Unit at Edinburgh calls dim robots.
Well, dim robots are the robots we have on the factory floor in all the advanced countries. They're blind and dumb, they don't understand their surroundings. And the other kind of robot, which will dominate technology of the late 1980s, automation, and also is of acute interest to experimental artificial intelligence.
At goals, how are we supposed to go about such a thing? Because basically the societies in human nature that have lived in harmony with nature in history, they don't seem to be very competitive nowadays in capitalism.
Yeah, you know, these apes that you descend from, they're all dead. But they're not dead because you killed them. They're dead because of old age, right, back then. They died to make space for their grand and great-grandkids. And they probably want their grandkids to succeed in the same way as I want my children and grandchildren to succeed. And to succeed, we need to adapt. The way in which you adapt an evolutionary environment is by mutation and selection. Well, everybody loves mutation, everybody hates selection, especially when you're being selected against. If you want to escape this, you probably need some kind of intelligent design, a way to adapt in situ, to adapt your organism without dying, without new generations. But we're not there yet. It's not possible in a biological evolution. A biological evolution engenders suffering. But when you look into the far distant future, you probably don't want your children to look like you, because the world is going to be different. If you want to settle Mars with your children should be adapted to living on Mars. And I think that some of our children will probably not biological. And I'm just looking for a way in which our biological and non-biological children can get along.
Okay, so we just become AI. That's a good plan. I get it. Thank you.
All right, let's move over to microphone number one.
Is there a place on this conference where interested entities can gather to keep this conversation going for the next days? Or, in other words, at which bar are you later?
I don't know yet. I will find out.
Okay, we will follow you.
All right, do we have a question from the internet?
I might tweet at which bar I am later, okay?
Hello. We have two questions from the internet. The first one is, what is the difference between individual consciousness and collective consciousness? And how does that differ from collective intelligence?
But it seems that if you look at an organization like a corporation, that it can be sentient, it knows what the corporation is, how it relates to the world and so on, but probably cannot be conscious because it cannot perceive itself perceiving in real time. It's not coherent and fast enough for doing that. And so you can probably also not be conscious across people. You can have entities that model collective agency on individual minds, and they can use the functionality of your own brain to be conscious in real time. But across people, that's very difficult, at least using AI. It takes something like 300 milliseconds to make a signal coherent throughout your brain. That's roughly the same time that it takes for a signal on the internet to go entirely around the globe. Right, so in some sense, we could build a real-time system on the internet, but we cannot use it, do it without AI.
All right, let's move over to mic number 3.
Hello. Have you reflected on how the cognitive format of a PowerPoint presentation and the format of a public lecture forces you to compromise on the substance of the issue at question? And if yes, what are your thoughts on that?
I have reflected a lot on this, and basically it's a medium, like other media. There are different media like books or personal in-depth conversation or lifelong study that lend themselves to very different explorations. If I give an hour-long talk at a hacker conference, my main goal is to be to blow your minds and get you interested, to develop a train of thought, to spend time on your own exploration, to make you curious, to bounce off ideas. And this is something about this medium is ideal. And I'm trying to use the medium for what it's good for and not be sad about the things that it's not good for.
Microphone 4.
Do you have any ideas for new collective agency, or maybe some tendencies that you've observed that are currently happening that you think might be suitable for new collective agency?
Yeah, I think that you'll find on social media